do with people and not to give them respect just for their world. If we need to respect them, we need to respect them for their humanity before anything else. Inshallah, we will continue this topic in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين.
The Light.
The Russian zoo is delighted to welcome a new resident, a rare snow white wallaby. The cute joey named Elisa was born at Regina Zoo in the southwestern city of Kazan. Zookeepers say she is healthy, playful, and has won the visitors' attention. Interestingly enough, Elisa's brother Alec was born with normal pigmentation. Wallabies are members of the kangaroo family. The albino wallaby, which has no skin pigmentation and pink eyes, is believed to be extremely rare. Circus and lab animals are getting a second shot at life after a Frenchman built a sanctuary using his own private funds. The sanctuary houses some large animals like rescued lions, elephants and hippos, but it's also home to some lab creatures that were kept for scientific studies, such as the macaques. Circus and lab animals are usually euthanized if they are not rescued. Owner and sanctuary investor Patrick Viola says every day he takes numerous phone calls from circus owners asking about free space at his shelter.
More than a zoo, this is a shelter. It is a refuge above all for animals that need it when there is no other solution. You know, we get 5 to 6 calls every day. Fortunately, in 90% of cases, our help is not even needed. You can't just call us and say, hey, I have a horse, I don't want it anymore. There are plenty of other options. We put a lot of people in touch with each other. People who look for animals and people who have animals they need taken care of. We accommodate animals when there is really no other solution.
Patrick says his shelter is one of 3 sanctuaries that are able to look after wild animals and the only one with the space capacity. He said he's planning an extension as a bill aimed at phasing out the use of wild animals in circuses passes through Parliament. Based on government figures, there are some 80 traveling circuses in France. The ban will be phased in over 5 years once the legislation comes into effect. First a hobby and now a money-making career. A Chinese artist creates objects out of wool felt in a studio in Beijing.
I came across pictures about wool felt art online by chance. I was very interested in this kind of material, so I did some research and started to try to make something. I've been doing it for about more than 10 years now. I didn't expect that I could do it for such a long time. At first, it was just a little hobby. I wouldn't have thought that I would do it as a profession.
Yin's current exhibition is themed on a warm sense of family unit depicted by cute and cozy mushroom-headed figures. One features a small mushroom-headed family, another features a life-sized adult and child with the same shape. Other artworks include plants and animals, but whatever the creations are, they are infused with human emotions, making people feel good. That's what the 31-year-old Chinese artist says. So far, she has been part of 9 exhibitions in China and Japan.
Let's go to Russia to take a look at St. Petersburg's largest celebration in spring, the Tulip Festival. Around 200,000 tulips from 100 varieties are on display in the colorful gala. It includes 15 extremely rare flower species. Russian artists also participated in the event to promote their traditional culture through various performances. The annual festival, held in Kirov Central Park, attracts hundreds of visitors. This year's event will run until late May.
French artist has placed the Eiffel Tower on a cliff using optical illusion on the famous landmark. In his work, street artist J.R. has removed the River Seine or Seine with an imaginary street that would go from the Trocadero to the Eiffel Tower. This work is a collage of several layers of paper which are not to last long due to the rain and the crowd that will walk on it. According to the artist's post on Instagram, the idea is to find a place perfectly reproducing the Eiffel Tower and have fun taking pictures by the imaginary cliff or jumping over the gaping chasm.
In Thailand, three sniffer dogs have joined the fight against the third wave of the pandemic in the country. The canines sniff hundreds of sweat samples per day to detect COVID patients who display no symptoms. The samples are from local medical volunteers as well as bedridden patients who are not able to show up at testing centers. Thailand's Social Development and Human Security Ministry is in charge of collecting the samples and delivering them to a university in Bangkok where the dogs operate. Researchers say the dogs can detect a volatile compound secreted in the sweat of COVID-infected people.
The distinctive scent is what would appear after there's an infection. Different kinds of viruses will produce different kinds of scents, therefore they contain different smells. The canines are very sensitive towards scents excreted from human body, and they have better sense by hundreds of millions of times better than us humans, without even having to come into close contact with the virus.
Researchers say the dogs have a success rate of over 90% in detecting asymptomatic COVID patients. They say the canines have gone through thousands of samples since early May.
Robots probably will never replace humans, but you must be worried they might steal your job in the future. A cook robot in Spain has risen to fame because of its ability to prepare paella, one of the world's most renowned national dishes. This robot is made up of an electronically controlled stove and a mechanical arm. It can put the already fried ingredients into the pan, add rice to it, and then stir it before pouring in the fish stock. The robot can prepare one paella at a time. However, all the ingredients have to be prepared and measured in advance. The Spanish company behind this product is trying to expand the robot's functionality.
They are designing what we have named Gastro Robot Menu, a robot gastronomic experience. Five chefs from the Basque Culinary Center are developing a five-course menu, so eventually we would take a seat in front of the robot and taste five courses designed by five important chefs.
Enrique says the product has already provoked interest outside Spain. He says some amusement parks and resorts in Japan already have their own paella robots. Paella masters believe the machine is a useful tool for chefs because they can cook many paellas at the same time. As the world continues to battle COVID-19, people are finding traditional and modern ways of remembering those who have lost their lives due to the pandemic. A public library in the U.S. is commemorating the victims with an origami project. The Greenpoint Public Library in Brooklyn, New York City, has collected 1,000 origami pieces since April. Inspired by the ancient Japanese legend that 1,000 paper cranes can bring well wishes or healing, the library aims to promote hope and a sense of solidarity. The delicate handmade cranes, many of them from recycled paper, are now on display in the library's lobby. The staff hopes that each and every crane brings hope to the community.
We made this for the COVID Remembrance Day event, month-long event. In many cultures, especially in Asian culture, it symbolizes peace, love, recovery, and hope. And especially in Japanese culture, Senbazu, 1,000 paper crane, is really significant. They believe that if one holds 1,000 paper crane, one's wishes come true.
The library has also asked people to come by and drop off their homemade origami as a memorial to the COVID-19 victims. It plans to keep up the display until at least the end of the summer. What was once an underground movement is now all the buzz. After a 17-year hiatus, billions of red-eyed cicadas are crawling their way above ground in the United States. These cicadas are known as Boudex, and they are beginning to emerge from the depth of the earth in a dramatic fashion. These birds have been sighted in 15 eastern states of America. They are around 4 centimeters in length with unforgettable bright red eyes and iridescent wings. Experts say these insects don't hibernate. In fact, they grow slowly underground for 17 years before they emerge to mate.
There are several misconceptions about periodical cicadas. One is that they're locusts. They're not locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers. Cicadas are much more closely related to aphids. There's another misconception that cicadas are harmful. Cicadas are not harmful. They don't bite. They don't sting. They're not going to harm you or your pet, so you don't have to fear the cicada.
Michael says cicadas tend to thrive on the edges of sunlit forests where it's warmer. They live above ground as adults for about 3 weeks, long enough to reproduce before dying. They lay eggs inside young tree branches, which hatch a few weeks later to restart the cycle. This year's cicada class will bore into the ground and won't emerge until 2038.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Peruvian zoo has showed off two baby crocodiles that were born through artificial insemination. The zoo in Lima celebrated their birth 3 months ago. Zookeepers say the two crocs are in good health. The American crocodiles now weigh around 70 grams each and measure 26 centimeters in length. However, it's too early to determine the gender of the newborns. American crocodile is in danger of extinction due to pollution and habitat loss.
A French musician has come up with an innovative idea to end his pandemic hiatus, performing on top of a mountain in Swiss Alps. Kehoe performed on a platform at an altitude of 3,000 meters. The 30-year-old artist braved sub-zero temperatures in April to perform. He also had to overcome his fear of heights. Kehoe has not performed in public for more than a year due to COVID-19 restrictions. He says the lockdown offers him a good chance to become more creative.
I feel like I had a lot of creativity during this period because I was stuck in the studio and a lot of time to make music. So usually when I perform gigs and I don't have so much time to spend in the studio. So today, during these days, it's like better.
A music production company organized the show. The small platform was taken up to the resort by helicopter. It took 4 hours to install the setting.
The best thing about Ayatollah Hadi Ma'rifat is that he was the one who made an independent book or an encyclopedia about Quranic sciences. We can see that he has referred to the Shia ulama and the Sunni ulama. But obviously, the thing which he has done, obviously, this was for the first time.
briefly speaking, he dedicates himself to the sciences of the Quran, and he spends the rest of his life, 40 years of his life, doing research on that. And the result of that is the most comprehensive and the largest book on the sciences of the Quran in the Shi'i seminary that has ever been authored, and that is At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher, and I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Dr. Murtaza Rezazadeh and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Dr. Rezazadeh, Assalamu Alaikum, welcome to the show.
Wa Alaikum Assalam wa Rahmatullah, thank you for having me.
And Sayyid Mohsen, Assalamu Alaikum, brother.
Alaikum Assalam wa Rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So in this new series of the program, The Teacher, we are mainly concerned with outstanding figures, thinkers, jurists and scholars in the world of Islam. And today we want to talk about one such scholar who was mainly concerned with the Quranic studies and Quranic sciences. He is no one but the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother. What information can you give us about the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat and his main field of study, that is Quranic studies?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat is one of the current scholars who was in this age, and we are lucky to have him in this age. And
of course, he passed away.
Yes, he passed away. But
he's contemporary.
He's not there. Yeah. He passed away a couple, yes. I think, like, yes, it's about 20 years ago.
15 years ago,
exactly, he passed right. away. So he's amongst the current, we can say, like, the scholars. Of this age in which we are, obviously, mm-hmm. living. And alhamdulillah, obviously, he was one of the scholars. When he passed away, I just remember of the statement of Ayatollah Jawadi Amli about him, mm-hmm. that he said, an angel has passed away.
Oh.
So that's how he was.
That's right.
And he basically belongs to a scholar family,
mm-hmm.
who used to live in Isfahan, and then they migrated to Karbala.
That's right.
And then they were living in Karbala, and obviously his kids, they were obviously born over there as well.
He himself was born in Karbala as well. Okay.
And still, I was talking to one of his sons, and he told me that the shops that are in between the Bainul Haramain,
that's right, like
between the Haram of Hazrat Abbas and Imam Hussein, okay. those shops are owned by their family, like their cousins and uncles.
Okay.
So they have rented this area. So basically, right. they are from the old, we can say, like, people who were basically based in Karbala.
Mm-hmm.
And due to the political reasons, when the Ba'ath regime came, obviously they have to migrate. So Ayatollah Hadi Ma'rifat himself was from a scholar family, and we can see in his forefathers, there were many generations who were the scholars.
That's right.
And according to some historical evidences, they belong to the scholars who are from Jabal al-Amil.
That's all right.
And this shows us, obviously, this has a positive effect on okay. a person generally.
Sheikh Abdul Ali Maisi, who was the grandfather from Jabal al-Amil. That's right.
A and okay. obviously, you know, when we talk about the scholarly families and in which, like, the generations are the scholars,
mm-hmm.
they have a very positive and, yes. you know, pure effect
yes.
on the descendants.
Yes.
Especially if someone comes to this line and okay. he continues the same,
yes.
You know, field, which yes. was from the forefathers.
Especially the region Jabal Amel is really rich
yes.
in terms of producing the scholars. You know, we have Najaf, Karbala, Qom, you know, Mashhad, okay? But the region Jabal Amel is also very important.
It is, obviously. Okay. And the main books that we have,
yes,
especially in the jurisprudence,
yes,
we have from the ulama, the scholars who were from the Jabal yes. Amel.
Okay.
From his teachers, if we want to say, like, who were the teachers, Ayatollah Khoi was one of his yes. teachers. Sayyid Hakim was from his teachers. Imam Khomeini was from his
That's
teachers.
Right.
And he himself, in one of his interviews, he described about all these teachers, like,
That's
specifically,
right.
like, and he talked about them, and he talked, like, how he benefited from each one of them.
That's all right. Okay, thank you much. Okay. Yes, great scholars you named, you know, Sayyid Abul Ghassam Al-Khoui and Sayyid Mohsen Al-Hakim, also the late Imam Khomeini. Okay, Dr. Reza Zadeh, let's get to you, brother. Do you have anything to add about the early education of Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat? And his main interest, his scholarly interest, it is Quranic studies. For sure, it has roots in some reasons, I mean, some motivations in order to get interested in the Quranic studies and the Quranic sciences.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, in addition to the points that was mentioned by Sayyid, I can just mention that Ayatollah Ma'rifat was important and different in some special cases. You know, before getting, let's say, very dedicatedly into the science of the Quran, just like all the other scholars, he was also mainly focused on the Islamic jurisprudence, because yes, that is the norm, and most of the scholars just do fiqh and usul, and jurisprudence and the principles of jurisprudence in Hawza, and he was also the same.
Yes.
But at the same time, when he was very young, he was working and he was working at a religious, let's say, journal.
That's right.
And he answered some questions. Mm-hmm. And it is said that once he received a question from one of the readers of the journal, and that question was like a turning point for him.
The questions, the answers to the queries that are posed by the people. Okay.
So, and that question was like a turning point for his entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed, actually, the direction of his life, in his scholarly life, in a completely different way, of course. And that change was so important and significant that at the end of the day, he became the most important and the most prominent scholar that we have had up until today in the sciences of Quran, in Shi'ism. And that is very important, because...
Really? Is he the most outstanding?
Exactly,
figure?
That's the point, you know, because for some different reasons, you know. Let me first say, what was that question, you know? That question was a simple question. Someone may say, okay, it's not a big deal. Mm-hmm. A person had asked, what is the ruling behind translation of the Quran, and what are the ideas of the Shi'i scholars regarding the whole concept of translation of the Quran? Is it allowed or not allowed? Okay. And, you know, there are some questions.
Yes.
This question was like something that was an inspiration for him. He wanted to answer that question, but he thought maybe he can give a more, let's say,
comprehensive answer.
So he started reading about it or do some research about it, and that research caused him to realize that one of the sciences that unfortunately the Shia scholars had not done enough work on that was the sciences of the Quran. Even those scholars who had done some sciences of the Quran was a very secondary subject that they had done something when they were writing some tafsir, commentary on the Quran. Some of the part of the, let's say, a very secondary part of their work, they did something about the sciences of the Quran.
Because, and what do you mean exactly by the sciences
exactly,
of the Quran?
Exactly. This is a question because many people do not differentiate between tafsir and sciences of the Quran, while these are two separate subjects. So when we say tafsir, we mean that something which is directly focused on commentary of the Quran, explaining the verses, what are the meanings of the verses, why has this verse been revealed, and, you know, something about the content and explaining the content. But when we mean sciences of the Quran, that's a different knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly the principles and general questions about the Quran in general. For example, what is the meaning of muhkam and mutashabih in the Quran? What are the verses of the Quran that have been abrogated? You know, very general questions, and also questions about the history of the Quran, questions about the different narrations of the Quran.
Or the places and the reasons for the revelations of the verses.
Let's say these are introductory knowledges that are needed for anyone who wants to start commentary. But at the same time, although it is a very important subject, especially it became more important in the modern era, the more academic approach to the more academic and historical approach was
to the whole
started to everything, including the religious concepts, this became much more into the interest of the scholars.
And not only for the scholars, but I think for the public, you know.
Exactly.
Because the people and the public, you know, used to getting just a mere recitation out of the ayahs of the Holy Quran or memorizing it. But I think these sciences, as you mentioned, that were tackled by Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat, opens the new window for the people to understand the Quran.
So he says, I went to do some research on this topic, on this very question, that he just finds one simple page of, you know, a very small piece of paper, that something had been written by one of the previous scholars. I think Kashaf al-Ghita had written something about it. And he becomes very upset because he knew that at the same time, just at that time, Sunni schools like Al-Azhar had done a lot of great jobs on the Quranic sciences. But in the Shia houses, in the Shia seminaries, nothing much had been done. So, briefly speaking, he dedicates himself to the sciences of the Quran, and he spends the rest of his life, 40 years of his life, doing research on that. And the result of that is the most comprehensive and the biggest, the largest book on the sciences of the Quran in the Shi'i seminary that has ever been authored, and that is At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran.
We will dedicate one specific or maybe several of our sessions to At-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Quran. This is really a great book, you know, done by Ayatollah Ma'rifat. As you said, you know, this is really a misfortune for the scholarly circles of the Shi'ism, you know, not to dedicate themselves to a question like this. And at the same time, you know, how much motivation must a person like Ayatollah Ma'rifat have in order to answer that question, and then, you know, that simple question might got to a 10-volume encyclopedia regarding Quranic sciences. Sayyid Mohsen, why do you think that Ayatollah Ma'rifat was interested in Quranic sciences? I mean, beside that question, what is the need to answer such questions regarding Quranic sciences?
Well, obviously, we all know that the Quran is the basic source of Islamic studies. And if someone do not understand the basics of a religion or a knowledge, he cannot basically interpret or explain about the verses, even the verses of the Quran. For example, this Quranic sciences talks about the history of the Quran. For example, it talks about the Siyanatul Quran, which is like the Quran is saved from being changed.
That's right.
It talks about Muhkamat wa Mutashabihat. Muhkamat are the verses that have the clear, you can say, like
reference and the meaning.
Reference or the meaning, there's a clear message.
Yes.
Whereas in Mutashabihat, according to some narrations, there are some hidden meanings which needs to be ta'wil.
Unrevealed, that's right.
Meanings, like you need to go behind the verse. It's not apparent.
Ambiguous, there is a type of ambiguous ambiguity in those.
Yeah. There is ambiguity because of, you know, there is one reason why there is muhkam and mutashabihat. Mm-hmm. Is because, you know, we can see within the Islam there is a school of thought.
That's all right.
Who takes the whole Quran as an apparent Quran. Yes. And we can see, like, within their beliefs, the belief that, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a body. That's has hands and legs and face like us.
Okay.
So it's because of that ambiguity which is in the Quran, whereas these things are obviously, they have a hidden meaning and we need to refer to them. Mm-hmm. So if someone cannot understand these things, he cannot basically interpret Quran.
That's right.
Cannot do any commentary on the Quran, cannot explain the hadith, the narration, and the Quranic teachings.
That's right.
And if we want to extract the things out of the Quran in order to refer or in order to explain what is Islam, we need to know about these sciences.
That's right.
Now, the best thing about the Ayatollah Hadi Ma'rifat is that he was the one who made an independent book or an encyclopedia about this topic, which is Quranic sciences.
Okay.
Before that, as Dr. Razadadeh has also mentioned, they were in the commentaries of the Quran.
That's right.
It was in the preface, for example.
Yes.
Even in Al-Mizan of Allama Tabatabai, if you see, in the first volume, in the preface, he has mentioned, in the introductory chapter, he has mentioned about these things. But he more referred to his methodology of interpreting the Quran.
Exegesis of the Quran.
So even in the book, these 10 volumes that we have in today's, like the new version of that we have, these are 10 volumes.
That's right.
We can see that he has referred to the Shia ulama and the Sunni ulama.
Okay.
the boat.
Okay.
So we have all of them there. But obviously, the thing which he has done, obviously, this was for the first time. Okay. And we can see in life of different ulamas. Mm-hmm. For example, Sheikh Al-Taifa,
yes.
Sheikh Tusi,
yes.
When he came, like he started to write the books that he had, he made them according to the topics and subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, we had the books like, you know, I have a rough book, for example.
Yes.
One day I write, like, for example, mathematics on the first page. On the second page, I'm writing about the chemistry, third page. The way I go forward, I'm just writing on that that book. There's one book only, notebook.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I can make different notebooks for different topics.
That's all right.
This was within the Shia Islam, within within the Islamic jurisprudence even. This was started by Sheikh Al-Taifa.
As a scholarly habit, you know.
Yes.
A mind is, and a methodology, that's all
so
right.
So we can see this in different people, different like scholars in their life. There was a turning point. There was something unique which they have added into the Islamic, we can say, resources.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Dr. Reza Zadeh, for your introductory remarks regarding the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. We will get to his most outstanding book, that is Al-Tamhid fi Ulum al-Qur'an, which is really, a masterpiece, the magnum opus of Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat, and we'll dedicate, inshallah, upcoming sessions of our program, The Teacher, to this script. That was very kind of you, Dr. Reza Zadeh.
My
and
pleasure.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi.
You're welcome.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the program, The Teacher, on the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hadi Ma'rifat. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Khalaf Islam page. You can also refer to our YouTube channel and Instagram page by the name Khalaf Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say,
am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد اللي حديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jalad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to be talking about Islamic laws about usury according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before dealing with these questions, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
We're going to talk about the viewpoints, the religious viewpoints of Ayatollah Khamenei regarding usury or riba. Let's talk about what it is that we call, or how do you define usury, all right?
Yeah.
From the start.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. The word riba means excess or increase, or you can say addition. There are two types of riba: riba in loan, in loan contract. If you give money to someone and then you place a condition for an addition, this is one kind of riba.
Mm-hmm.
And then this kind of riba is technically in Arabic terminology, or maybe in legal parlance, it is called riba an-nasiya. And then we have another type of riba, which is riba in sale or exchange contract. Sale and exchange contract, which is called riba al-fadl. Mm-hmm. Okay. These are the Arabic words which have been, of course, which are used by the scholars and ulama and jurists, of course. Riba in English language can roughly be translated as usury, as you rightly use the term. And of course, it means unjust exploitative gains made in trade or business under Islamic law. Of course, Islam is strictly opposed to riba, and of course it has been condemned in several different verses in the Quran. Not only the Quran forbids it, mm-hmm. condemns it,
yes,
but also there are numerous traditions from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and the imams, the infallible imams, who forbid giving and taking riba or usury. And I would like to just recite a verse from the Quran. This is verse 278 of chapter Al-Baqarah, where the Quran says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَذَرُوا مَا بَقِيَ مِنَ الرِّبَى إِن كُنْتُم مُؤْمِنِينَ فَإِن لَمْ تَفْعَلُوا فَأَذَنُوا بِحَرْبٍ مِنَ اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ وَإِن تُبْتُمْ فَلَكُمْ رُؤُوسُ أَمْوَالِكُمْ لَا تَظْلِمُونَ وَلَا تُظْلَمُونَ. And of course the verse continues, وَإِن كَانَ ذُو عُسْرَةٍ فَنَظِرَةٌ إِلَى مَيْسَرَةٍ وَإِن تَصَدَّقُوا خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ إِن كُنْتُمْ تَعْلَمُونَ. Of course, this verse should be translated for our audience, because they should understand what this verse is about. This is one of the clear verses of the Quran referring to the prohibition of riba. According to this verse, taking and receiving riba is not, of course, in consonant with the spirit of believing in God. And of course, the belief in God requires the abandonment of usury. Now, the verse, to give a translation, a brief translation of this verse. The translation reads as such: O you who believe, O you have faith, be wary of Allah and abandon all claims to what remains of usury, should you be faithful. And if you do not, then be informed of a war from Allah and His Apostle. This actually indicates that if you take, if you receive usury and riba mm-hmm. from someone, it is as though you are going to war against Allah and the Prophet. You are fighting them. It is such a grave sin.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Is it talking about the creditor or debtor, the person who lends the money or the person who receives the money?
In both scenarios, you see, giving riba and taking riba.
Uh-huh.
And even if someone is there who writes a contract and who witnesses the transaction, which is usurious which is based on riba, or which is interest based,
mm-hmm.
is forbidden. So there is it's absolutely forbidden even for a third party. Okay, let's say they we two have a deal. We are entering a deal, and we do not know how to write the deal. So we ask someone else to write it.
Usually they refer to the lawyers.
Yeah, of course. That person giving your pen to be used for writing that contract is not permissible according to a hadith. And of course the verse goes on, if you repent, then you will have your principal neither harming others nor suffering harm. لا تظلمون ولا تظلمون. If the debtor is in straits, okay, if the debtor is in a difficult condition, let there be a respite until the time of ease, okay? I owe you some money, and mm-hmm. I know that you are not in a position to give back your... To pay back the money. So, according to the Quran, I should give you some respite so that you...
Yes.
Yeah, so that you can earn the money and give it and whenever you can. The verse says, and if you remit the debt as charity, it will be better for you. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Quran and Hadith also clearly indicate that if that person continues to be unable to pay repay the loan or pay off the debt, his debt, then it's better for you, not mandatory, better for you to remit it as charity,
mm-hmm.
to consider it as sadaqah and charity, and let that be and relieve him of that
duty
obligation,
to pay back, yes.
Of that duty,
yes.
to pay back. So this is one of many verses of the Quran which clearly refer to the prohibition of riba, and of course, as I said, riba is not in consonant with the spirit of believing in God. It is against the prophetic teachings, and of course, riba has negative impacts on every body's life, on the giver,
mm-hmm.
and on the taker.
Right.
Of course, there is there's a hadith which says someone who receives riba,
mm-hmm.
okay,
yes.
receives riba, is like someone who commits incest,
mm-hmm.
In the house of God. You see,
wow,
such a grave sin, and you can imagine how serious and how grave this sin is. So the infallibles, the Holy Prophet peace be upon him and his household emphasize and stress on giving charity to the needy, and also helping the needy, reaching out to those people who are in need, and having a transaction which is not based on usury or on riba. Because if you take that in addition, you cannot possess that, okay? For example, if I give you $1,000 and then expect you and place a condition to give me $1,100, okay, $1,100, okay? That $100, which is an extra amount,
mm-hmm.
I cannot possess it. I cannot take ownership of that money because it's haram. And no haram property can be possessed or owned by you.
Thank you very much, Sheikh
Javid.
That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahimun Mannan Kareemun Salamun Aleemun Majalilaha
According to the New York Times, Israel has already informed the United States that its forces had targeted the Iranian ship Zavis in the Red Sea. In this context, the unnamed American official who spoke to the New York Times said that the Israelis consider this attack as a retaliation for what they call the previous Iranian strikes that had targeted Israeli ships. To add more drama to the matter, the Israelis claimed that there had been a delay in their attack to allow the American aircraft carrier in the region, Dwight D. Eisenhower, to remain at a safe distance from the Iranian ship, which Israel claims is a military one. The damage to the Iranian Zavis vessel came as progress was reported on the first day of talks to revive American participation in the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and major world powers. Israel, which regards Iran as its most potent foe, strongly opposes a restoration of the agreement, which was abandoned by the Trump administration 3 years ago. Commenting on the attack, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh told reporters that the Zavis ship was struck by the blast at around 6 a.m. local time on Tuesday, April 5th, near the coast of Djibouti, and sustained minor damage. No fatalities were caused by the incident, and technical evaluations on how the incident occurred and its origins are still underway. The Iranian official emphasized that Tehran will take all the necessary measures regarding the case through international bodies. Rejecting media claims, Khatibzadeh said that Zavis is not a military vessel whose specifications and mission have been formally registered with the International Maritime Organization. In a similar incident last month, an Iranian cargo ship was damaged after it was targeted by a terrorist attack en route to Europe in the Mediterranean Sea. Tehran said back then that such acts of terror are a clear example of naval piracy and run counter to international law and the safety of commercial vessels. Welcome to the Middle East stream. I'm Marwa Osman. An Iranian cargo vessel stationed in the Red Sea was damaged by an Israeli mine attack on Tuesday, April 6th, in an escalation of the shadowy naval skirmishing that has characterized Israel's animosity with Iran in recent years. The attack came as Iran and world powers sat down in Vienna for the first talks about the U.S. potentially rejoining Tehran's nuclear deal, showing that challenges ahead do not rest merely in those negotiations. Now, to discuss this issue with us from California is Paul Larudi, former U.S. advisor in the Arabian Peninsula. Thank you very much for being with us, Paul, at such an early hour of the day. I really appreciate it. It seems that the break that Israel had taken during the Trump administration for halting the nuclear deal came to an end when talks now are underway in Vienna for the JCPOA. But now Israel seems more aggressive, pushing for a confrontation at any expense with Iran by targeting the Iranian cargo vessel. How do you think this will play out if Israel continues with this, least to say, reckless behavior?
Well, Israel wants confrontation. It's always shown it. It's part of its history. And it's doing it again. The result of this will be that Iran will retaliate. And it has shown that it will retaliate, for example, with the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani and the attack on the Ain al-Assad American base inside Iraq. So this is likely to be what will happen. Of course, Iran will do so proportionally. That's what they did in the case of the assassination, and that's what they will do again. And it's also the way Hezbollah functions. So there will be retaliation.
Well, Israel, which regards Iran as its most maybe potent foe in the region, strongly opposes a restoration of any nuclear agreement with Iran. And the latest that we saw is the attack on Natanz power plant as well. What does that have to do with Israel to begin with? I mean, how would an international agreement threaten Israel in any way?
Well, from Iran's, Israel's point of view, the problem with the agreement is that it lifts the sanctions, and Israel wants the sanctions to continue. It wants to harm Iran as much as possible. Iran is standing in the way of Israeli expansion and weakening Israel's neighbors. Because a powerful nation like Iran can come to the aid of Israel's neighbors. So this is part of the Israeli general strategy of weakening its neighbors, and mm-hmm. it wants as much confrontation to exist, whether from Israel directly or from the United States and other countries, to weaken Iran. So that's its objective.
Well, we did hear Tehran, and the last time that there was such an attack on an Iranian vessel, it happened last month in March, and on the Mediterranean Sea while the vessel was en route to Europe. But Tehran said at that time that such acts of terror are a clear example of naval piracy and run counter to all international law on the safety of commercial vessels, reiterating that it will retaliate to these acts of aggression. What are the Iranian options here? Will it just become an eye for an eye in the open sea?
Well, I think ultimately there may be some of that, an eye for an eye. And Israel has shown that it cares nothing for international law. It will behave the way it wants to. It needs some action, some retaliation, and some disciplining, as, for example, Hezbollah has shown. I mean, Hezbollah has been attacked, its members have been killed, and it has retaliated, and proportionally. And the result is that Israel becomes quiet because they know that Hezbollah has the power to do that. Well, it's the same thing with Iran. Israel has to learn that Iran's not going to take it, and that the only discipline that they're going to get is an Iranian retaliation. So there may be a tit for tat, an eye for an eye, for some time. But I think ultimately Israel will see that this is useless and that it harms Israel more than it harms Iran.
Well, it seems that several regional files are being put on hold waiting for the breakthrough talks of the JCPOA and the return of possible diplomatic relations between Iran and the U.S., basically from Yemen to Lebanon to Syria and Iraq, and now the Israeli-Iranian feud. Are we exaggerating if we say the entire West of Asia is right now at a crossroad?
If it's not right now at a crossroads, it soon will be, with things going the way they are. In fact, the sanctioned nations are becoming a kind of common market of sanctioned nations. They are helping each other. They are finding allies. Iran just signed a 25-year economic agreement, $400 billion with China, and it's and Russia also is participating in this kind of sanctions common market. Even the European nations have kind of found another way to get past the sanctions for certain purposes. So things are changing. The power of the United States is extending its power beyond its means, and the result will be that the other nations will get together and find ways around it and to develop their own power base. They need to do that because the main threat is the United States.
Well, wouldn't that bear the question of when that happens, wouldn't the United States go all out for a war to try and retake the position that it had lost?
It's always possible, but I don't think the United we can hope that the United States population will resist that, because the U.S. population is being impoverished, and is without resources. More people are on the street. The homeless population is growing by leaps and bounds. And to have this greater burden than they have now, when half of their entire national budget is going for defense, more than half, in fact. I think the United States is reaching the limits of its capabilities, and we're watching a superpower decline.
Mm-hmm. Well, it definitely is something to look out for in West Asia, especially when Israel has been very blatant about its attack on whether the Islamic Republic of Iran or other allies of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the